Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about everyone's favorite subject, taste. Well, maybe it's not everyone's favorite subject. It's mine, and it's everyone's most personal subject because taste is so personal. But one of the things that we like to talk about here is how, in fact, those personal tastes lead to more collective tastes. And that's somehow how we color our society, let's say. And today we're talking to someone who has an interesting perspective on taste as an architect of some of the great iconic restaurants of our time, everything from Blue Hill at Stone Barns to Red in Yountville. I'm joined today by Peter Guzzi, founder, co-founder of As For Guzzi Architects. Thanks for being with us in the studio, Peter.
It's great to be here, Mitchell.
So, Peter, we have had many conversations about the relationship of dining and design, the sort of taste equation writ large of the restaurant, in part in preparation for a series we did earlier this year of panel conversations with architects and chefs called Dining and Design that the James Beard Foundation put on with the New School. And I thought that maybe just for fun, we would pick up a little bit of the conversation that we started then, because I think it's an ongoing and ever-evolving thing, this relationship between food and hospitality and also service and the physical environment in which all of those things come together and are hopefully enjoyed. Tell us a little bit about how you approach a restaurant project or what you think is unique about working on restaurants compared to some of the other architectural projects you do.
Well, restaurant projects have a great fascination because we are brought into a close relationship with a chef and or an owner and an idea about what a restaurant can be. And we usually begin, we try to begin with the food, which we kind of see as the DNA of a restaurant design. And we try to take that DNA and discover a chef who knows how to make food and can conceive of a beautiful dish and how to put it on a plate and how to combine different flavors. We try to extend that same notion into the architecture and into the design and into the experience that people have.
So if you are working or trying to get to know a new client who is a chef, let's say, not all restaurants are owned by chefs or operated by chefs, it should be said, but in this instance, and they cook something for you, what do you think is important about the food? What are the elements that you think, I mean, obviously you're not going to, maybe you are going to use the colors and literally transform the presentations into the environment, but what are you looking for?
Yes, you're right. It's more abstract than that, but I guess we're looking for an approach to cooking. How you conceive of a dish, how you combine flavors, the complexity or the simplicity, how you put it on the plate, how you tell a story about food with a dish. We try to tell a similar story about a place with a design.
And, well, let's talk about one in particular. Let's talk about Stone Barns, Blue Hill at Stone Barns, technically. And since it's such an iconic restaurant right now, and we could have this conversation about other ones also, and we will. Did you know Dan Barber before that project began?
We did know Dan and his sister-in-law, Laureen, and David, his brother, because we had done Blue Hill in the city, which we did in 2000. And at that time, Dan had a very small catering company and thought he would start a restaurant like so many do.
Mm-hmm. But then this larger project comes along with perhaps a different vision or at least a different ambition than a little restaurant on the side of a catering company. And And not just a restaurant, but a restaurant really with a mission, I guess. So double the work for you, not just what the intent of the food is, but also what the mission of the whole project is.
Absolutely. And it was such a gift to work with the Barbaras on this project. In fact, when we first did the restaurant in Manhattan, I remember even before demolition was complete on the space, Dan made a meal for us.
Oh.
So it was his idea as well, as it is with many chefs, that the best way to communicate is actually through enjoying a meal together.
Right.
And then when we went to Stone Barns, of course, some of the really vibrant and clarion cooking that Dan practiced for several years in Manhattan, it really had a chance to be brought to another level of clarity and another level of course, sourcing mm-hmm. materials, where his integral relationship to the Stone Barns Agricultural Center allowed him to be involved in how the animals were raised, what kind of breeds were being used, what kind of produce was being produced, and then how that was then folded into his recipes mm-hmm. and his conceptions.
So what do you see, and you don't have to name names, or you can name names because this is internet radio and you can do whatever you want, but what do you hate about restaurant design today? Are there things you hate about sort of trends or even just specific techniques or things that people are see in restaurants?
I wouldn't say I hate anything, but I prefer some things over other things.
Okay.
And the great gift of doing a restaurant is not just to make a place where you can serve food, but it's to create a narrative together with mm-hmm. the chef, with the cuisine, with the idea of service, to create a story. And it's a story that you inhabit for a few hours. It's a place where you go. And everything that happens during that experience, whether it's ordering a bottle of wine, whether it's going to the restroom, whether it's paying your check, is all part of that that travel that you take. And I think when restaurants tell a story which is honest and genuine and true to the nature of the story that they're trying to write, then it's an enjoyable experience.
Okay, that's a diplomatic answer. And we've talked about this question in so many different areas on this show and just in general, but what you mentioned that when the story is authentic and true, what does that mean in architecture? What is authentic architecture versus inauthentic, or I don't know, what the opposite is?
I think what it means is that the elements of architecture, like the elements of cooking, are not arbitrary. You don't combine spices in an arbitrary manner with a dish. And I think the same goes into how you combine materials and lighting and making of space in a formal and an informal way. It all boils down to what is the experience. And in a way, when you walk into a space, it should say something to you, like the first bite of chicken cacciatore when you put it in your mouth. It communicates something. And I think the space should have that same rendering. It's difficult to describe what is the right design for this type of idea or that type of, or this narrative or that narrative. But when you get it right, the restaurants actually don't need to be redesigned. If the concept of the restaurant is strong, then most of our restaurants, to our great pleasure, don't get renovated.
Interesting. Wow, that's an interesting way to measure your success, in fact, as an architect, I think, if it stays the test of time. Which makes me think of a place like the Four Seasons restaurant, not the hotel, but the restaurant, a great collaboration of architecture and food and ambition and lots of money. Would you consider that a successful story?
I think it's one of the most phenomenal stories, if not the most phenomenal story, because you would know better than I. Is it 50 years now?
Yeah, more 50 and a few, 50 and change.
50 years that a restaurant has remained relevant and interesting, and they've been able to reinvent themselves. And the room has stayed virtually the same. Mm-hmm. And I think that's testimony to a tremendous design. And what's so great about the design is that it holds one of the factors we find very important, that a restaurant should be of its place. And with the Four Seasons, it's in the Seagram's building, mm-hmm. in New York City. And it embraces both of those two qualities in such a beautiful way, the way you come into it and move up through into the bar, then over the bridge, past the Picasso weaving, past the wine room, into the pool room. It's one of the most beautiful sequences, almost a formal sequence, rendered with great precision. Only perhaps a souffle is more difficult to achieve. And when you arrive in the room, you're at once, you've experienced walking through the middle of the Seagram's building, and you're on a corner, on a northwestern corner, facing out to the city through these beautiful shimmering draperies. Mm-hmm. And there's at once peace and serenity by the pool, which the seats are very cleverly oriented around, so not everyone actually needs a window seat, mm-hmm. often a problem.
Interesting.
And you also have this view of a bustling 54th Street and Park Avenue constantly moving perpetually behind you. It's a magnificent confluence of different types of experiences. You're there in the Seagram's building, you're there in New York City, and the service, I believe, has stayed pretty impeccable, and the food still amazing for a 50-year restaurant.
Right. I once asked one of the owners, Alex von Bitter, if he, what it felt like to have such a timeless piece under his control, a timeless sort of piece of New York history, as you said. And he said, well, it's timeless now, but there was a good 10 years after the first 10 years when we were just dated. And then if you can survive long enough, they became sort of iconic. I mean, you know, I think everything in that place has found its way into the collection at the Museum of Modern Art. But so the way you describe that reminds me that working in New York City has some severe limitations, not the least of which is the amount of space, the cost of the real estate. And I imagine it'd be very difficult to fathom a restaurant of such luxury of space being created at this time in New York's history. What do you find challenging and what is rewarding about those challenges of working in such a tightly packed urban environment as New York? I mean, a lot of the restaurants you've worked on are here, but you've done others, as I mentioned. Is there something about New York that makes it fun to work in, or difficult, or all of those things?
It's fun. It's more fun than it is difficult.
Yeah.
Each space, large or small, holds a well of challenges and of possibilities. And, you know, discovering those possibilities is the real pleasure, together with a chef, with an owner, is the real pleasure of doing these projects, and not just doing something generic, not doing something that's been done before, but really finding the essence of where you are and what the space is that would really represent the food and the place. We were just talking about the Four Seasons. One of the most important aspects of your experiences is neither food nor architectural. It's Julian, who is an amazing man, who's the maitre d', and the way that he plays that room like a Stradivarius is there are few people who actually do it well, but when it's done well, it's a cogent part of your experience.
Right. And to what extent does architecture contribute to that? I mean, obviously there's the flow you mentioned. We don't have to talk about the Four Seasons, but I don't think people who eat in restaurants always think of the influence of the physical space, unless it's something jarring. But really, I mean, as you once said about Stone Barn, someone said to you, there was almost, they thought there was no architecture there, that they just found a barn that looked like that, which, I mean, maybe you can talk a little bit to that. That wasn't the case, but does it have to recede to be effective, or is it part of the experience? What does it do?
I think it does have to recede a little bit, because it shouldn't really be a dominant aspect of that story. I think in the end, it's a very simple definition that we use in terms of what makes spaces good. Are they comfortable? Mm. Do you like to sit there? Do you imagine yourself coming back in 2 days and eating again? Now, the latter has to do with the food, obviously, but the former has to do with the place and the service and your whole experience.
We're going to continue this conversation with Peter Guzzi, co-founder of Aswar Guzzi Architects, who designs many beautiful spaces, including some of our favorite restaurants. You're listening to Taste Matters. I'm Mitchell Davis. We'll be right back.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, as you just heard. And today we are talking about architecture and the narrative of a space and how that narrative relates to the story told by the chef and by the service and by the whole experience, I guess, of hospitality. And we're having this conversation with Peter Guzzi, who is the co-founder of Aswar Guzzi Architects, who have designed some great places. We've talked a little bit about Blue Hill at Stone Barns, and I was just at Red in Yountville and didn't realize that they had designed that one also, another very comfortable, beautiful space. What's the surprise factor in designing a restaurant? Obviously you have an idea, and then I'm asking this with some personal information. We're renovating an apartment, and you know, it wasn't until demolition that we were told we would find out what really is going to be possible. And so obviously you have your idea, you write that story, you have a relationship with the chef, but then, you know, who knows what's going to happen when you start to build and fill it in or take it out.
We have found the best projects really don't happen quickly, but they get developed over time because they're not based on a single a priori notion, but they're really based on a close, very close collaboration and development of ideas and a sense of place. And sense of place is so important because there are technical things, of course, that make you feel good in a restaurant. There's lighting, there's acoustics, the right amount of acoustics. A bar, you want less. A restaurant, you want to be able to speak to a person, but you don't want it to be too quiet or you hear the salt moving in the salt shaker.
Number one complaint, we had Dave Chang on the show last week, and he said in his profile in Vogue magazine this month that he hates his restaurants. They're too fucking loud, is what he said.
But at other times, he's also said that he picks out a list of songs, which tends to be very loud
right.
as well.
Right. Anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt, but he just said.
So a couple of little technical things give a sense of place and give comfort. But the notion of what a place is, you wouldn't want to just kind of write down on a piece of paper. You really want to develop it slowly. Over time, we've done all these blue ribbon restaurants, and they're all a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And there are similarities that run through them, and each one is different, and each one is a separate entity. And that's been interesting to do 12 or 13 restaurants with one set of people, trying to take each one as a new project.
Sure. So what is consistent in the... What would you sort of hold on to convey the feeling of similarity, but also make each one unique?
I think the thing that runs most consistently through the Blue Ribbon restaurants is, and my partner and I, Edward Aspor, we've been doing Blue Ribbon restaurants for 21 years.
That's a neat project to be able to say, I think.
It's wonderful, and we have a close collaboration with them. I think the thing that runs through most consistently is Bruce and Eric Bromberg's attitude towards hospitality, towards treating people, towards making food, towards making a place where people come, which is kind of, frankly, when it started, the, you know, anti-formal restaurant. Mm-hmm. It was unpretentious. It was easy.
Long before that was the norm, in fact, come to think of it. I mean, it was the place all the chefs went late at night, the original Blue Ribbon, and it was casual in a way that restaurants have since become, you know, of big reputations, let's say.
I think it was one of a bit of a harbinger, mm-hmm, of those ideas. And it's really from what Bruce and Eric saw as a kind of restaurant that they would enjoy, of a kind of menu that usually has 100 or 200 or 300 things on it, the kind of food that they would want to eat. They didn't want to actually put restrictions on what they did. They actually kind of wanted to celebrate their French background, their Jewish background, their American background. They wanted to embrace what they liked without a formulaic approach. And from that, Blue Ribbon was born, then incorporating sushi in a strange kind of way,
right?
but with the same attitude, where the sushi chef was actually not the person ordered to, and you didn't get this kind of paranoia that if you don't speak Japanese, you won't be able to enjoy the food. They kind of put it through their own filter. Still making great Japanese food, but making it more accessible in a slightly different way and with some different twists.
I should remind people listening that if you have questions or you want to contact us for anything, or maybe they're questions about architecture, or maybe they're just questions about restaurants or where to get a good piece of sushi, you can write us at info@heritageradionetwork.org. If you prefer to tweet in 140 character comments, we are Taste Matters HRN. So what's funny to me in this sort of quest for place, as you mentioned, let's build a comfortable environment in it that's sort of fits in its place and also tell a story that is authentic and enduring, is that food is probably one of the trendiest things in the world right now. And architecture in the last 20 years, in America anyway, has also been super duper trendy, it seems. How do you navigate through that? Or, I mean, without the luxury of 50 years to see what's going to stick, how do you put those two trendy things together and come up with something that might last? Or, I mean, I understand there's no one way, but talk a little bit about that.
Well, we're very lucky because we've worked with really exceptional chefs and exceptional restaurateurs.
Name a few more, because...
Our first restaurant was Allison on Dominick Street. We've worked with Bruce and Eric Bromberg for many restaurants, Richard Reddington, Dan Barber, Peter Hoffman.
At Savoy.
Back 40, Back 40 West. And these are chefs who are not, and thinkers, who are not flash in the pan, fashion-oriented chefs. These are chefs with deep ideas about food, about cooking, and about hospitality. And we've really mirrored that, in fact, in all of our non-architecture work as architects, which is substantial. We see architecture as a timeless practice. And a good piece of architecture, a good place, should stay that way. And you see it in the Four Seasons.
Right.
It's 50 years old. Right. It's still a restaurant. You step down those three steps, it's an event.
Right.
It's actually it transcends being a restaurant. You arrive there, it's always an event when you go there.
Yeah, for sure.
And to design a place that doesn't need to be renovated, that actually works, of course, you need a good restaurateur who's going to do good food and great service, and who's also going to know how to constantly change and grow with the times. No menu is static on a day-to-day basis. If a new chicken purveyor comes, the chicken dish may be way off, and it needs to be retooled. Good chefs are constantly adjusting these things and fixing these things, but there's a consistency and a constancy about their quality. Mm. We try to mirror that with the spaces we make for them to present what they do.
So you also served for many years on the committee that oversees the Restaurant Design Awards for the James Beard Foundation. And I'm wondering, with submissions coming in from all over the country and other places also, not just America, and also sort of young and up-and-coming architects, I imagine, who've submitted, and also old and established ones, what are things that, just trends that you are liking or appreciating? What has changed in the time, the 20 years that you've been working with the Brombergs, that you see that you like? And how has our interest in and sort of obsession with food and restaurants and chefs changed, perhaps over time, the relationship of architecture to those enterprises?
One thing I've noticed, one thing we have noticed is that there's a move away from a formality. And there used to be more concise boundaries between formal, casual, cafe, bistro.
Right. They meant something.
and I think that these divisions have changed. Formal restaurants seem to have more trouble actually maintaining themselves. And in a way, I don't think casual is the right word, because it's too broad. But a simpler kind of place, and I read that as a simpler kind of experience. I think the thing that's so important about restaurants is people. Mm-hmm. And we sometimes lose sight of that. Mm. That a great space, great food, great service. But in fact, it's how people interact with, in fact, 300 or 200 BC, Epicurus said that before you find food and drink, you have to find people with whom to eat it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we would just be wolves and lions, or
okay,
something like that. So the what people do for a restaurant is really critical, and I think that people want more choices, want more flexibility. Mm. And the whole notion of a standard meal with an appetizer and an entree and a dessert is not for every night that one goes out. People want more options. People want simpler options. People want more accessible options. And I think maybe what the Blue Ribbon was doing years ago, and many other people too, has really become more of the prevalent model. Mm. Mm.
Well, it's funny to be having this conversation, looking through a window onto Roberta's dining room, you know, certainly one of the most famous restaurants in New York City, among all the chefs in the world who've been through here. And design-wise, you know, design might be too strong a word, but it hasn't stopped the sophistication of the food or of the hospitality, really, or of the whole experience, because of the people and because of the environment here.
Well, I think this gets back to what we were speaking about before, Mitchell, that this space is in situ to where it is. It is the genius loci of this place is genuine, mm-hmm. and real and palpable. And I think that comes through when you're here. It's not trying to be in a different part of Brooklyn. It's right here. It's the kind of food they're making. It's the kind of great attitude that they present. Hmm. So it's in that way, it's enjoyed. It's successful, and it hits the right note.
And I guess that what more success could you want in experience, which is the theme of the whole conversation we've been having. This relationship of the food and the chef's vision, the space and the place that it's located in, the experience of the people moving through it, all sort of being of that moment in time. Thank you for coming out to Roberta's, to Bushwick, to talk to us, Peter. It's always a pleasure.
Pleasure being here, Mitchell.
We will continue our conversations about taste next week with Marion Nessel, who has been on the show before, a great food politics what would we call her? Advocate, I guess, food advocate, or a scientist with a conscience, let's say, who'll be back to talk about a lighter story of a new book that she's got, a book of food policy cartoons. Maybe not for children. Maybe they are. I don't know. We'll hear all about it next week. In the meantime, why don't you go to your favorite restaurant and instead of just focusing what's on the plate and who's sitting across the table from you, take a look around. Take it in. See why you like the components of the actual space and the architecture and the design and think about how they relate to the story that you are enjoying. You're listening to Taste Matters. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.